One of the things that I notice as I visit so many of these countries around the world is that the people there have goals. They know what they are trying to achieve. Some people, of course, don't believe you should have goals. There is an old saying that goes along the lines that if we don't have any goals, then we will be pretty sure to achieve them. They may not always achieve their goals, but at least people know that they are setting out to do something. When we look at the Bible, I'm going to just look at a couple of references in a moment. In fact, you could find your way to Romans 15 while I'm talking. So I want to refer to the Apostle Paul and see that he had goals, that he had a strategy, that he knew what he was doing. He followed, for example, along the Roman roads, and he went into the major population centres, and there he planted churches. And his goal was that having planted the church, that church would then become the jumping off point for the spreading of the gospel in the region to plant other churches around the province. Then he would move on to the next major population centre along the Roman road. He'd do the same thing. It's good to have a goal, it's good to have a strategy, but it will only work if those churches have the sort of life that would make it work. There is nothing in having a goal or a plan that is going to guarantee success simply because it happens to be a plan. Everything is going to depend on the life and vitality of the people concerned. And in the case of Paul, his plan worked where the churches he planted were of sufficient spiritual caliber to ensure that it functioned and that they did spread the gospel into those regions. He started off, if I can just go through his journeys very quickly, he started off from Antioch in Syria, he moved across to Cyprus, then he went into Asia Minor. He moved up into the central highlands region of Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, Derbe, and he planted churches in those places. And from those places, the word spread around. It says so in the story concerned in the book of Acts. He came back to Antioch, and then he set out on his second journey. This time, he didn't go through the Mediterranean island of Cyprus. He went straight up over the mountains into the highland region direct. He revisited the churches he'd planted on his first journey. He was heading for Ephesus, I believe, but God redirected him, which shows that although we have plans and goals and aims, we must be sensitive to the leading of God's Spirit. And so God redirected him and took him up into the northwest of Turkey to Troas, from where he got further directions that took him across into the north of what we today will call Greece. He traveled through that part of the world, came back, and that was his second missionary journey. The third missionary journey, he did this time go to Ephesus, which is where he spent most of his time. Here, he still had plans, but he had completed the main work that he was doing in that part of the world. From Ephesus, he wrote, well, it may have been after he left Ephesus and was moving up through the north of Turkey and then across to Macedonia with the intention of coming to Corinth again. He wrote to the church in Corinth to prepare them for his arrival, and this is what he said. We do not boast beyond limit in other men's labours, but our hope is that as your faith increases, our field among you may be greatly enlarged, so that we may preach the gospel in lands beyond you without boasting of work already done in another's field. So he was now going to go across to Corinth again, and at this point, Corinth is the farthest west that he has been. He says, I'm just going to visit you again, but my aim is now to keep going west. When he got there, he wrote the letter that we call the letter to the Romans, which is the one I ask you to find your way to, chapter 15. And here he says, this is now the next goal that I have. This is the next stage of my program. I have started in Syria. I have moved west through Turkey. I've moved west now through Greece. I'm going to move further west again, this time to Italy. And he says, I have always been keen, in verse 20, to preach the gospel in places where Christ has not already been known, because I don't want to build on somebody else's foundation. He says further, as you look down into verse 23, he says, I no longer have any room for work in these regions, and since I have longed for many years to come to you, I hope to see you in passing as I go to Spain. So I've finished my work here, now I'm going further west to Spain, and I want to be sped on my journey by you once I've enjoyed your company for a little. At present, however, I'm going back to Jerusalem with aid for the Christians there, and then after I've given them the money, I'm going to move back and come to you in Rome. So you can see that the Apostle Paul has goals. He knows what he's doing, he knows where he wants to go, and he seeks to fulfill those goals. This talk is mainly concerned with world mission, with world evangelization, and I want to spice it with all sorts of references and illustrations from some of the countries I've been to, or am familiar with, or in some way I'm cooperating with. The world has changed, and we should see how different it is now from what it was, let us say, 100 years ago. 100 years ago, approximately 10% of the church, that is the evangelical church, I'm not speaking of nominal Christianity, I'm speaking of what you and I would accept to be the real thing. About 10% of the Christians were from the non-Western world. But then after World War II, things really started to change, especially during the 60s into the 70s. And 40 years ago, it had grown to about 30%. 20 years ago, it was 50%. Now, it is up around 70%, and it's expected that by the turn of this century, it will have reached 75%. That is, 75% of the Christians in the world will be from the non-Western world. Now, we have to balance this because although there is great outreach and great growth in some of the countries of Africa, also in some of the places of Asia, and of course Latin America, we have to realize that in what is known as the 1040 window, that is an imaginary box that you can draw across a map of the world, which stretches between 10 degrees and 40 degrees north of the equator, and stretches from West Africa through the Middle East across Asia to East Asia, in that area, which contains about 60% of the world's population, 95% of the unreached people of the world still live. But in terms of missionary force, of anybody taking the gospel to those people, they are underprovided for. They have less than 25% of the missionaries. The people who are concentrating most, it seems, on reaching the unreached are people from what we loosely refer to as the third world, that is the non-Western world. And I'm impressed as I go around some of these countries to see not only their enthusiasm for evangelism in their own country, but the great burden they have to reach the unreached, and especially the difficult countries, some of the Islamic countries of the Middle East, to find creative ways of getting in and evangelizing those people. I now want to just look at half a dozen examples. These are all from different countries. Most of them I've been to, but some I haven't. But they're people I know and ministries I'm familiar with in those countries. I've just got half a dozen. And we're looking at the sort of approach that these people have to their work, whether it's in relation to their own country or countries that they're trying to reach into roundabout. The first one I want to mention is Chad. Chad, of course, is in the north of Africa, sub-Sahara Africa. In fact, Chad straddles a region that stretches over Islamic areas in the north through to more Christianized areas in the south. But there was a ministry that started there a few years ago where they targeted all the unreached villages in that country to seek to put a church there. Now, as it so happens, the initiative came from some brethren people. The man who was most behind it was a man called René Didanzo. But he had other helpers who are similarly gifted and full of vision. They established an 8-year plan based on the 8 regions of the country. And the idea was to target each year the villages where there was no church. So for example, if there are 78 villages in this region that don't have a church, the aim is now to put a church in each of those villages this year. If they don't succeed in getting all 78, they might only get, say, 53. Well, the others will have to wait, because the next year they're going to move on to the next of these 8 regions. Again, target the villages and reach into those villages and plant a church. One of the things they did was to levy the Christians in Chad $3 each so that they could buy 26 trucks. I heard this story first from René Didanzo when I was sharing a conference with him in Italy. We both, of course, were speaking through interpreters. René was speaking in English, which is his fourth language, So he's got his local languages, and then all his education was in French, and now he's speaking in English. He's being interpreted into Italian. But he was sharp enough to pick up that the interpreter didn't get him straight. Because René said, we have levied all the Christians and all the assemblies in Chad to provide $3 a head, which is a lot of money. When you're only getting the equivalent of $200 or $300 a year, $3 a head is quite a bit to come up with. The idea was to buy 26 trucks. Now the interpreter said 26 cars, but René, although it wasn't his language again, it was Italian, he knew enough to pick up that this man had said the wrong thing, and so he said, now our brother here has said 26 cars. I didn't say 26 cars, I said 26 trucks. Because you fit a lot of people on the back of a truck, especially in Africa. You've seen pictures of how they can transport people around in large quantities. But that was their vision, and they were going for it, even though economically and many other ways it was difficult for them. There are now over 1 million Christians out of a population of only 6 million in that country. There are over 1,000 brethren assemblies alone, to say nothing of the other churches. And not only has this been effective in that land, but the vision has spread to other countries. And now other countries are doing the same sort of thing that was started in Chad. They had a goal and they went for it. They didn't get discouraged if they didn't achieve completely the goal that they'd set out for. Nevertheless, they accomplished most of what they were after. The second country I'm referring to is Indonesia. Now, Indonesia, like Chad, is a country that I have been to Indonesia, but I haven't been there in any significant Christian ministry. It's a large country, as you know, 170 million. I think it's, the fourth largest country in the world by population. It is certainly the largest Muslim country. But there are about 5% of the people there who are Christians. They are suffering persecution. In spite of that, the church is growing. There is a fanatical element among some of the local Muslim people. The church nevertheless enjoys a degree of freedom. But there's one man there, a man called Chris Marantika. He's a Christian man who runs a ministry. I met him, first of all, in Manila some years ago. In fact, we were in neighboring rooms at the Lausanne Congress on World Evangelization. He has a plan called 111. The plan is to plant one church in one village in 1 year. They've worked this out so that over 20 years, if you get the right number of people involved, you will have a church in every village, in every town throughout that country. I'm not sure if I've said that exactly correctly, but anyway, you've got the picture. One church in one village in 1 year. The plan was a 20-year plan. I was speaking to Chris after they'd passed the halfway point, and already they were ahead of their goal. That's quite an ambitious goal, but they were beating their goal, so to speak. Here's another one from the Philippines, also a country in our region. The Philippine Missionary Fellowship is a local ministry that was started about 40 years ago. It grew into an indigenous ministry that was concerned with evangelizing within the Philippines. It's not a missionary-based organization in the sense of Western missionaries coming in. It's a local Filipino initiative, and all the people in it are Filipinos. You may recall a few years ago when Gay and I were in the Philippines and she was hospitalized for some dramatic surgery. Well, it was actually that a conference for this mission that we were at when this crisis emerged. It was the annual get-together of around about 180 of these Filipino servants of God. I was running studies there for that week. That's my connection with them. But the man that I'm working most with is Nonilo Sanchez, who is the head of that organization. Now, here's a survey of what has happened in 40 years. In the first 30 years, they planted about 90 churches. That's significant enough, I suppose. It's not record-breaking or anything like that, though I should imagine that if we could look at a group of churches here that in 30 years has planted 90 new churches, then it's something to be moderately satisfied with. But in the last 10 years, they have planted over 200 churches. Do you get it? 40 years they've been going. In the first 30 years, 90 churches. But in the last 10 years, 200 churches. So if you're looking at a graph, this is the way it goes. It sort of slowly rises and whoops, then it goes up quite rapidly. That turnaround came around the 1990 mark, late 80s, early 90s. It's amazing how many countries I go to or hear from where that period around 1988, 89, 1991 has been quite a dramatic period for a sudden surging of progress in their evangelistic activity. Some missiologists or other people who research these things may be able to come up with some explanation. You can go back earlier to the early 1970s, 70, 71, 72, through that era, and again there was quite a dramatic increase. And so there we go, another 20 years into the corresponding period, two decades later, and this dramatic increase again. But these people are not going about their work just hoping to keep the system going and saying, oh well, if we just maintain status quo and keep each other happy, then it'll all be okay. No, they've all got their goals. In fact, I left at home the goal that I had from this Philippine Missionary Fellowship as to what their goal is now for the next 5 years, how many churches they want to plant. But I've at least given you what has happened in that last 10 years, and you can see again this rapid growth taking place. Their goal was not to be satisfied with what they had. They wanted to keep on going and increasing this rate of church planting in unreached areas. That's my fourth country, the Philippines. The fifth one is Nigeria. And Nigeria is a country that really is so dynamic. Anybody who's been to Nigeria will tell you it's one of the most difficult countries in the world. It has the most robust church, but politically, religiously, economically, socially, it's a seething mass of tension and chaos. It's a highly populated country, the 10th most populous country in the world. One in four Africans is a Nigerian. They are the dominant country of Africa. But out of this aggression and turmoil that there is in society comes a church which is vibrant and focused and really motivated, not only towards evangelizing their own country, but evangelizing the world. There are missionaries from Nigeria in countries round about all over Africa. In fact, not only Africa. Almost every country I go to, whether it's in Eastern Europe or Africa or Asia, sooner or later I seem to bump into a Nigerian or hear about a Nigerian. And wherever they go, they make waves. I just want to tell you about Christian Missionary Foundation. This was a local ministry that was set up, again, by local initiatives. The man who set it up was a fellow called Ruben Ezimadu. I first met Ruben when I went to the Lausanne Congress on World Evangelization in Manila in 1989. I went along to an elective which was called Third World Missions. I thought it was missions to the Third World, but when I got there, I found it was missions from the Third World. And the person who introduced the very first session was this Ruben Ezimadu. And in 5 minutes, he said more that was focused and perceptive than sometimes I will hear in a 30 or 40 minute sermon at a missionary conference at home. Then he introduced four or five people who gave papers over the next hour and a quarter. One was from Brazil, one was from Korea, one was from Indonesia, one was from India, another one was from Nigeria, five people. Again, those papers were so sharp and focused. I certainly made it my business to get to know some of those men afterwards. We become quite involved with providing some of them with resources through our Bridgeway books. It was Ruben Ezimadu, this Nigerian, who invited me to Nigeria a couple of years later, where I had quite an extensive ministry. And it blew my mind. I've never been the same since. It was a shattering experience to see this country that is in such chaos and yet to be challenged by a church that is so dynamic. They are all full of ideas and they're all goal setters. I was there just after the 10th anniversary of this mission. When they started, they had set themselves goals. I can't give you these exactly, but they went something like this, that after 3 or 4 years they wanted to have at least so many converts, and then after training so many of these, they then wanted to see X number of people as pastors of churches. Within 5 years, they wanted to have so many churches, and they wanted to have sent 5 missionaries into unreached tribal groups within Nigeria. Within 7 years, they wanted that number now to be 10 or 12, and they wanted the first missionaries to have gone into other countries, and so it went on. By the time they got to their 10 years, they had exceeded every goal they set themselves for the 10 years. And at that stage, they then had 15 missionaries, Nigerian missionaries, serving in other countries. And whereas most people in the West will run a mile rather than talk to a Muslim, because we're dead scared of them, think they're going to pull out a dagger or a gun or a hand grenade or blow people up or something like that, when you go to these other countries, they are queued up wanting to be missionaries to the Muslims. how can we get to reach the Muslims? What creative ways can we think of to get into some of these closed countries of the Middle East? They are not short on courage, the Nigerians. And so they set these goals and sent people out far and near into all sorts of ministries. I've got here this book, pretty unattractive, it's just print, print and more print. It's 16, 20 pages. They put it out every 3 months. It's just news summaries and prayer points, and it goes through day by day over the 3 months. But this is the vision these people have. Every day there is one item to pray for within Nigeria and one item to pray for in other countries around the world. And they're not just praying for their own mission areas. But look at the places they're praying for. I'll just pick these out at random. Tibet, Albania, Malaysia, Liberia, East Timor, Tibet again, Turkey, India, Iran, Israel, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Burma, Turkey, Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, Equatorial Guinea, Senegal, Mexico, Brazil, Australia, Indonesia, Cambodia, Hong Kong, Bulgaria, and just so it goes on and on and on. These people, in a country that is in such ongoing crisis, they have a vision for the world that would put most of us to shame. And here they are praying and praying and praying for countries all over the world. When you go to see these people and attend some of their prayer meetings, I can tell you it really stirs you. One of the places some of those Nigerians went to was Central African Republic. Now, I haven't been to Central African Republic, but I know this man that I'm going to quote here. He was one of the Nigerians. Having served the Lord in Nigeria, he then went as a missionary to Central African Republic. These were the goals. Again, this piece of paper, you can see it here, it's very plain, just a black print on white paper, no fancy pictures and glossy colours or anything like that, but these are the facts. Our goal, within the first 5 years, I went out in 1995, and so their goal before the year 2000, is to convert and disciple 500 believers. Not a bad goal. That's not a bad goal for this church. Say, in the next 5 years, we want to convert and disciple 500 believers in this locality. That's what they're doing, 500 believers in 5 years. They want to establish a Bible and training mission school in Bangor, which is the capital of Central African Republic, for the training of some of these people. They then want to raise 50 cross-cultural missionaries who will, in turn, target 10 unreached peoples in Central African Republic by the year 2000. The next goal, to promote a holistic ministry in that region through interdenominational seminars, through conferences, mass evangelism, distribution of relevant Christian literature, audio and visual tapes in both English and French at subsidized rates. Incidentally, this man who went in there had to learn French before he did all this, because they are Nigerians and they are English speaking, not French speaking, so had to learn French first. Next point, the empowering of these Bible school graduates to train others. And then the final point, to expand our ministry base to 3 other North African countries by the year 2005. So the 5-year goal I've just outlined, and then within the next 5 years, they want to reach out of that country into 3 North African countries. When they say North African countries, they don't mean sub-Saharan Africans, Negroid Africans. They mean the Muslim countries of North Africa that border the Mediterranean Sea. And so they want to move up there. Some of those, of course, are French-speaking. And so these are places where folks from Central African Republic can go. What a challenge to meet these people, to get their literature, to hear from them, to be fed their news. Let's move on to my next country, which was Nepal. Nepal is one of those countries that has come from only a few Christians 10 years ago to quite a lot of Christians now. Nobody knows the exact figure, 200,000, 300,000. Out of a mere couple of hundred 10 years ago. And the growth is so rapid that the Hindu Federation, the World Hindu Federation, which is based in India, is very angry about all this and is leaning on the Nepalese government to try to clip the wings of these Christians to curb this growth if they can, because Nepal is a Hindu country. I could tell you a lot of stories about Nepal, but one particular place, I was there in Kathmandu, and the Christians tend to be in 2 or 3 major areas of the city. But I was with one particular ministry, again just local Nepali people. The house I was living in with them was an orphanage, so to speak. They'd taken in about 10 orphans, and then they'd taken in a few more and had another house just a few doors down the street. And they found also that there were some elderly people neglected, and they had another house just across the way, had these three houses where they were looking after disadvantaged people. I happened to ask a question in the course of things, did they own this house? And they just looked at me and said, own the house? They said, we don't even own a church. I was a bit embarrassed about this, because here is me, right at that point, we were just in the process of selling our house back home and moving to another location and thinking about all the things we should do with the house that we were selling and buying another. Here were people that didn't even own the house, and he said, we have other goals before we have a house for ourselves. How can we have a house for ourselves? He said, we don't even have a church building. He said, we have to meet in some place. He said, we've started a Bible school. He took me to the Bible school. I have about 60 students there now. The Bible school is in a state of constant construction, one of these places that never looks as if it's ever going to get finished. It's bits and pieces stuck on here and whatever materials they can get. And he said, our goal is to get this Bible school finished. We have a plot of land, he said, that we have for a church. We want to build the church. And when we've got that built, then we will think about maybe getting a house for ourselves. But in the meantime, we just rent these humble dwellings that you can see here. But the real point of this story that I was going to tell you was that they are not in the areas of Kathmandu where there tend to be a few more Christians. They saw a ring road that encircled the city, and they surveyed this ring road and identified 14 localities around the ring road. And most of these had no Christian witness. There were no churches within them. And so they said, we are going to put a church into each of these 14 areas. And this area where we are now is one of those 14. And we've got one next door where we are just about at the stage of calling it now a church that we've started. It may not have a building, but at least it is a church of people. Here were people that had goals and targets moving around. In another part of Nepal, a place called Paktapur, which is out from Kathmandu, there was another man who'd started in a similar way. He'd started 8 years ago. It was very tough, but he grew from zero Christians to about 200 now. He said these 200 are in 17 groups, and because of the nature of work and locality, it's very difficult for all these people to be in one place at the one time. So he said, we really have to move around constantly, these 17 groups, seeking to instruct and teach and encourage the Christians. But again, you see that goal, that strategizing, that moving forward, how they should do it. I've just got here, there it is. I brought this back from Nepal. That again is a daily prayer guide. I can't read a word of it, of course, but you can see that it's set out over 30 days. I am told by the people who gave this to me that they are all items of prayer for countries, first of all for Nepal, but for countries elsewhere in the world. The same breadth of vision that seems to be lacking in our country, there it is in Nepal. The final country I want to refer to is Myanmar, otherwise known as Burma. Went through a very tough time. You couldn't get into the country or get out of it very easily for a long, long time. It's been a military dictatorship for most of the last 30 or 40 years. A very oppressed country. They told me that there is no country in the world where the government is more hated by the people it rules than the country of Burma. And people within Burma will tell you the same. It's not oppressive as in some of the Middle Eastern countries where people trail you around and it's dangerous to be a Christian, but it's oppressive in the way the church is stifled. It's not allowed to expand, it's not allowed to build buildings, it's not allowed to run things legally, and so they do it illegally. What happened there was that around about the same time, or the year before, the Tiananmen Square massacre in China, there was a similar sort of event in Burma. And the outcome of that was that the government closed the universities, closed the centers of learning. But some of the enthusiastic Christians, they got these young people who didn't know what to do now because they couldn't study, and they started to teach some of these Christians the Bible. Unofficial Bible schools started. And out of that, the thing multiplied. And from these places went forth what I call an army of barefoot evangelists who started to evangelize and to plant churches. Now these Bible schools are all very rough and ready, 20 or 30 people in some very primitive accommodation. The churches likewise, because the government won't give approval to build new buildings or to operate openly, so they just operate this other way. The government closes them down, they move some other place, and they just mushroom, they just come all over the place. The sort of thing that we hear about in China happening there in Burma. There's a Brethren church that we knew a little bit about. the days when I used to live in Thailand, one or two people from Thailand, missionaries, used to go there to try to encourage the local believers. Only a handful of them, a dozen or so. But there again, around the late 80s, around that 80, 88, 89, 90 period, the work took off and it expanded and it grew. Now, of course, we can go into Myanmar. I've been there a few times. The government opened up. Instead of letting you there just for one day, they let you there for a week. Now we can go for a month. And there are still some difficulties. But that church that struggled and struggled and struggled for several decades, I was there a few years ago, 700 people in that church on Sunday. And they have now spawned 24 daughter churches, if that's what you want to call them. I'm not sure if it's a registered church or not. There are, of course, government spies who come to all of these churches every week just to suss out things and to make sure people don't say the wrong thing. But they have got to a stage now where they are large enough to not only stand on their own feet, but to produce 24 other churches. They are the centre for Emmaus correspondence courses, the centre for FEBC radio. They run their own Bible school. They have various other training ministries. I think they have about 8 or 10 people who are now full-time in that ministry. They are short of funds, they are short of facilities, but they just keep pushing on. I'm just going to show you this. This is written in Burmese, and once again I can't read a word of it. But you can see from that illustration, with the box drawn across part of the world, that that is the 1040 window I referred to earlier. And here they are, in Burma, day by day, praying through countries in the 1040 window. You can see it there, set out 30 or 40, it looks like, on that page, praying through these difficult countries. They live in a difficult country themselves, but they've got this breadth of vision. Their goal is simply to keep on growing and expanding and to plant more and more of these churches and then to see these churches develop. The latest I hear is they want to now set up a pastor's training school. Apart from the Bible school, a specific pastor's training school. Because they have to put elders into all these churches and leaders and pastors and teachers and evangelists. And so they want to equip people for the leadership roles. A spin-off from that is that in Bangkok, one of the family members of the man, a man called Ronnie Tin Mong Thun, who's the motivating driving force behind this work I've just mentioned in Burma, one of his sons went to Bangkok, partly really to raise money to help support the ministry back home, but he started doing similar things, reaching Burmese refugees, illegal immigrants and other people that flee that awful country. Actually, it's a lovely country in some ways and some lovely people. When I say awful country, I'm referring to the government that runs it. Thailand is full of illegal immigrants, refugees from Burma who come across the border. So these Burmese started to evangelize. And they saw a small group start, and then another group. And I was there just a year or so ago, and I preached on a Sunday to this Burmese group. It had to be interpreted into Burmese, of course. Over 200 in that church. I was there in August, and they said, "We have had baptisms once a month. Normally 4 or 5 or 6 people once a month this year." But he said there's a Baptist place a kilometre or two down the road. They have 400 every Sunday, and he said they have had baptisms every Sunday this year. God is doing something amazing among the Burmese people, especially, as I said, those who seem to be leaving Burma. And the converts are not just coming from tribal people who have been semi-Christianized over the years or have been exposed to the gospel. The converts are coming also from the Buddhist population, that is the people in the plain land areas, not just the mountain areas. And many of those have been highly resistant to the gospel. Well, there it is. That's my run through the half a dozen countries. Oh, I must show you this. This is, it looks like a newspaper, doesn't it? Just look at that. Page after page of nothing but print. Not a picture, not an illustration, not a graphic in the whole 16 pages. If you open the 2 pages out like that, it's about the size of a tabloid newspaper. There are 4 columns of print on each page. And all the people in the church get this once a month. The material that is in there, just look at it. 16 pages of it. They've actually translated quite a lot of my material and published it, but a lot of it is just written by the local Burmese Christians themselves. But they're feeding the church, and the people take it home and they read it and study it. Here, of course, just to get people reading, you have to glossy it up with pictures and illustrations, high quality production, keep the actual print to a minimum and make the graphics dominate, and then people might be attracted to reading it. But here it is, nothing but print, 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 print. That's why the church is growing. That's why the Christians are growing. They're growing because they've got a visionary leadership that is feeding them on the Word of God. I might show you this too. I was through Singapore just recently and preaching in a church there. This is a Presbyterian church. Their vision for mission. It's incredible what's coming out of Singapore. You wouldn't believe it if you read the goals that they have here and the level of support that they offer. They certainly make people in Australia look rather sick when it comes to the amount of money they give and the goals they set themselves. This is just one church. Our aims, our biblical basis, the requirements for candidate for missionary service, the financial support for missionary full-time Christian workers, short-term missions, mission exposure trips, tent-making ministries. Seven items here in this central fold-out telling you what the aims of the church are. The church will consider to provide on a case-by-case basis monthly living expenses up to a maximum of $3,000. In addition, required airfares, medical and accident insurance policy, clothing allowance, theological training, language study courses, and missions training will be provided. Fellow support for 3 months will be given upon completion of every three-year term, and a return passage will be provided to other countries. Debriefing and counselling will be provided. I'm not going to read it all to you. But these people, again, are focused. They know where they're going. They have goals. They have aims. And as a result, the church in Singapore is growing. It's one exception to the affluent West. Most of the affluent West is going downhill. We have been hooked on materialism. Singapore, which is in many ways more affluent than our country, but here it hasn't eaten into their spirituality the way it has in Australia. And you have operations such as this that I've just waved in front of you that show us how these countries are providing much of the support, the ammunition, the backing, the resources for people who are going out into world mission into unreached parts around the globe. All right, I'm going to leave it there. My time has gone. But the Apostle Paul had some goals. These people had some goals. And I hope that you and I have some goals also.